This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 246, was recorded on November 19th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by the Perth Mint, one of the world's largest precious metals enterprises and the leading provider of trusted gold investment products, including their latest offering, Gold Pass, and by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. Tresis Chief Economist and Fund Manager Daniel Lecaille is back as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss what's holding the stock market up as the vaccine news is offset by a marked increases in cases and deaths, bond yields, inflation, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, where we'll have an update on the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis, as well as another of Patrick's famous post-game chart books. Macro Voices will be released one day early next week on Wednesday, November 25th, due to the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday on Thursday.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has more or less been trade range bound in this 3,600 area going into the Friday close. What's your thinking on the next move here on the market?
Well, I'm seeing more and more banks and pundits saying sell the vaccine. And to put this in context, we're going to get an update in the postgame segment on the vaccines and the coronavirus and so forth. But the executive summary is, look, the vaccine news really is terrific news, but it's news about things that are likely to take about a year or so to play out. In the meantime, what we have right here, right now, is a marked increase in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And I think for a while, the market was just, you know, giddy about the vaccine news. And finally, we're starting to discount in the reality that, okay, the vaccine news really is good news, but it doesn't take effect until next year. And the right here, right now news is this situation's getting worse, not better. So I think there's been a shift in thinking around the pandemic. And we got to remember, too, that everybody's so excited about, oh boy, if this pandemic were finally over, well, that would be a panacea. It really wasn't a panacea before the pandemic began in terms of our economic situation. Stimulus expectations, I think, are still going to be the big driver. So I do think that there's eventually more upside in this market, but I think that the vaccine news has already been priced in, and it's now finally being offset by a little bit of current situation reality. Meanwhile, the runoff elections in Georgia in January still leave open the possibility of the Democrats taking the Senate. And I think that has some significant market implications, particularly on the assumption that Joe Biden really does win the presidency, which seems the very, very likely outcome. But, you know, it's not quite over yet. And there's some interesting things going on in that debate as well. So we'll see how it all turns out.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar because it remains so weak at the bottom end of that range. We're trading just above the 92 handle right now. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, it's interesting that both the U.S. dollar and gold are in the same situation, which is they're just teetering right on the bottom of their trading ranges. In the case of the U.S. dollar, it's a 92 on the dollar index, and we still haven't seen a daily close below it. We're hovering just above it. And when we get to gold, we'll see that we're just hovering just above 1850. So I think that the fundamentals are still kind of muddy here. As far as trading the dollar index, I'm not remotely interested in it because the call on whether or not the dollar is going to appreciate or depreciate against other fiat currencies, that's hard. It takes some real thinking to figure that out. The question of whether the U.S. dollar is going to continue to depreciate against gold and other hard assets is so much easier to figure out. So it's very easy for me to say, why would I even think about trading the dollar index when I can just be long gold?
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because crude has been edging actually higher, surprisingly, and we're trading very close to around the 42 level right in here. What's the situation and how is it developing in oil?
Well, Patrick, the vaccine news has definitely been a major driver of the strength in crude oil. The thing that's crazy about this, and it always happens the same way in crude oil, it's never made sense. What you would think would happen, since we do have separate prices in this market for each monthly delivery contract, you'd think that the crude oil futures for delivery a year from now, let's say December of 21, would be through the roof to the upside, because that's when the good news is really going to take effect. And you'd think, if anything, they'd be down right now on all the hospitalizations and deaths. It generally just never works that way in the crude oil market. When people get excited about future good news, what they buy is the front month contract, even though it doesn't make any logical sense to do that. So I think the reason for the strength in front month crude oil prices is driven by hopes and expectations about the vaccines. And you know, this just doesn't really make sense to me. We've got a lot of reason to be concerned that we're headed for harder times, worse times, before it gets better. And then when we're able to eventually distribute vaccines, it'll probably get a lot better. But that's not now. That's coming up next year. As far as inventory this week, a lot of analysts were expecting a significant drawdown in crude oil inventory. Instead, we got a build of 768,000 barrels. We also got a build of 1.2 million barrels in Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline drawing down 2.6 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 5.2 million barrels. U.S. production up 400,000 barrels to 10.9 million barrels. So that decline in U.S. production, which would be very bullish for prices that Art Berman and several other analysts have begun predicting into next year, isn't happening yet. We're moving in the other direction for now. As you say, Patrick, we're really right on the very top end of the trading range. Looks like we're on the verge of a breakout to the upside. It doesn't make sense to me. I think that the virus fundamentals, in terms of what we're really seeing, should say that we're looking at an economic slowdown and a reduction of crude oil demand in the next 6 months, and it's likely to pick up dramatically in the second half of next year. I think this is a lot of premature optimism, but we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, we have to talk gold, because gold really, it hasn't really done anything since last week. I mean, we're pretty much trading at the same level when we were talking a week ago. We're hovering around 1864 right now, and it just seems very heavy here. What's the next move in gold in your mind?
Well, we hit 1850 today on an intraday basis, and that's been the intraday low for, I don't know, the last 5-6 months. We've hit it 5 or 6 times now, and that seems to be the number to get through. Meanwhile, the 200-day moving average is up to 1805, so that's only $45 lower than that 1850. And then there's another technical support level at around 1757. So I'm thinking that it really depends if the vaccine news continues to be good, which it seems like it is, and that helped gold to come down. And if we get a final resolution to the presidential election, I think there's room for gold to correct lower. How much lower? I'm not sure. I don't think it's going to be a huge correction down to 1400 or any of that, especially if in January we get a Senate that goes to the Democrats and Biden is confirmed as the real winner of the election. So you have effectively that blue wave where the Democrats control both houses of Congress and the presidency. I think if that happens, it's got to be really good for gold, because you know that with one party in charge of everything, they're going to spend, and they're going to debase the value of fiat currency in the process. So I think a lot depends on that Georgia runoff election, but I think until gold has its next big move up, there's plenty of room for a correction. And 1850 seems to be the magic number. If we can see a daily close below that, I think it probably begets at least a move down to 1805, maybe a move down to 1758.
All right. Finally, let's touch on that 10-year treasury yield, because we were almost at 1% last week, and we now have backed off for about 85 basis points. Was that it for the advance in yields, or is there more higher interest rates coming?
I think higher interest rates are coming. I really don't have any short-term outlook or opinion, but in my mind, what's really happened here, I've been thinking a lot about this, is I think the big trade, and it was an incredibly profitable trade for a lot of people, of being long duration, is pretty much over. I just don't see a move in U.S. Treasuries to deep negative territory. So I don't think there's a lot of upside on being long duration. And I certainly don't want to short this market. It's really important to remember, too, a lot of people are saying, okay, 38-year bond bull market, you know, if I can just call the top and short that thing, I'll make a fortune as it goes the other direction. Well, wait a minute. If you look at interest rates bottoming at the end of World War II, they just stayed at about the same level for like 10 years before there was a meaningful move to the upside. And I think that we've got a setup for the same thing. Interest rates, I think, are bottoming or have bottomed most likely. But that doesn't mean they're going to reverse direction. If you look at the expectations that we have around MMT and so forth, they're probably going to continue to suppress interest rates to very, very low levels for as long as they can get away with it until inflation starts to run away. That process probably takes a few years to play out. At some point, you get runaway inflation and a backing up in yields, and it gets really ugly. That's, I think it's coming, but we're nowhere close to that yet. So I don't think there really is a trade here other than short-term swing trading if you're good at that kind of trading, which I'm not.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Trust's chief economist and fund manager, Daniel Lacaille. Now, Eric, why did we invite Daniel back as a guest this week?
Daniel is a super smart macro guy, and I'm really feel as so many Americans are just consumed in this presidential election and political stuff. It's good to get European voices on the show who can, obviously, they follow what's going on in the U.S. economy, but they're able to speak to it with that dispassionate perspective of an outsider. And Daniel's got some terrific perspectives that are coming up in this interview.
Eric's interview with Daniel is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after the message from our sponsor.
Financial markets are facing unprecedented uncertainty, driving investors to gold as a trusted store of wealth. For a simple, secure, and easy way to trade or invest, consider GoldPass, the Perth Mint's market-leading precious metals app. GoldPass allows investors to buy, sell, redeem, and transfer precious metals 24 hours a day at the touch of a screen. Trade as little or as much as you want with no storage fees. With live gold prices, research, and interactive charting to help you decide when to trade, you can get started for as little as $1 worth of gold. Each digital certificate is 100% backed by physical Perth Mint gold stored in Western Australia, one of the safest jurisdictions in the world. And all assets traded by GoldPass carry a government guarantee. This means you can redeem your GoldPass holdings for bullion at any time and have your gold delivered direct to your door. Build your wealth with GoldPass today. Download the app in the Apple or Android store or visit perthmint.com/GoldPass.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is author, fund manager, and chief economist for Tresis, Daniel Lacaille. Daniel, it's great to have you back on the show. I always look forward to getting your perspective as a European. Here in the United States, we have an interesting situation, which is, you know, presidential election is still contested, although it looks almost certain that Biden will win. At the same time, we have, on one hand, a great big increase, both in the United States and globally, in coronavirus infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. On the other hand, we have two bits of very promising vaccine news, one from Pfizer and just a new one Monday of this week from Moderna. Stocks rallying to fresh all-time highs, or at least on a closing basis, it would be a fresh all-time high at the numbers we're seeing right now in the S&P. What do you make of this? Is it the vaccine that's doing it, or was this market just ready to move higher after the election anyway?
Thank you so much, Eric. And I think it's a very, very interesting situation because I think that we're living in an environment in which markets start to sometimes double and triple discount some news, no? remember that markets had already rallied on the hopes of a prompt solution with a vaccine coming from AstraZeneca, then the Pfizer news. Now we see markets rally again with the new tests from Moderna saying that their vaccine is 94% efficient. I think that what we are looking is at an environment in which investors are almost looking at any excuse to buy particularly equities, because what they also discount is that there's going to be a concerted effort of financial repression from central banks, that the bond yield environment is going to continue to be extremely tight, that we are going to continue to see central banks depressing bond yields all over the world. And therefore, almost any piece of news flow, even if it's something that should already be considered discounted, is an excuse to buy equities with the prospect that bonds will continue to be extremely expensive. I think that also what happens is that you have an environment in which people know that this is not going to make huge differences to economic growth estimates for 2021. Remember that all of consensus estimates and the big international bodies' estimates for 2021 already assumed the positive effect of a vaccine and the end of the pandemic.
Daniel, I'd like to run my own hypothesis past you, because although I do think that these mRNA vaccines offer a lot of promise long term, maybe they will solve this crisis. Look, at least in the case of the Pfizer vaccine, the refrigeration requirements alone would make it nearly impossible to distribute on a wide scale until they make some significant improvements there. Moderna looks more promising, but even so, if you add up what it's going to take to get beyond the clinical trials, resolve the problems, get these vaccines to the point where they truly are ready to be scaled up for mass distribution, and then you do the production and the distribution and you figure this all out worldwide, I don't see how it could be any less than the second half of 2021, probably the fourth quarter of 2021, where you would even begin to approach the point where you've actually vaccinated enough people that now it's safe to travel. You know, enough of the population has been vaccinated that essentially the crisis has been averted. It seems to me like, best case, that's still a year away. But what we have right here, right now, which nobody's really paying a lot of attention to, is a massive, almost parabolic spike up, not just in new cases, which could be a reflection of testing, but also in hospitalizations and deaths. So it seems to me like what's really going on is this crisis is about to get a lot worse before it gets much better about a year from now. I don't think that's what the market is discounting. Am I missing something? Or is there maybe a downside surprise before it eventually gets better?
I completely agree. I think that markets are only accepting the positive news flow without analyzing the real path to the widespread distribution of a vaccine. And even if you look at, for example, the messages that Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Moderna are saying, you're absolutely right. We're talking about the latter part of the second half, best case, third quarter of 2021. And in the meantime, you have a much worse situation in Europe, much worse situation in the United States. The hospitalization rates are much higher. The level of tightness in the intensive care units is extremely, extremely complex right now and very, 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 very challenging. So I think you're absolutely right. Things will get worse before they will get better. However, I think that for the average investor, it is almost the following. When you get very bad news, as you've seen, for example, in Europe, what you bet on is that central banks, European Central Bank, will massively increase the stimulus package, increase the purchasing program, launch a bazooka, as they call it, etc. And when the news are good, you just buy it because the news are good. You see what I mean? Is that the level of risk taking that an average investor is adding onto a portfolio is completely disconnected with the reality of the path of the vaccine. Obviously, a very, very, very positive piece of news flow. However, very challenging in terms of distribution. You just mentioned the storage complications. But even in the most benign scenario, which I recently put in my Twitter feed, the most benign scenario assumes that by the end of 2021, less than 38% of the population at risk will have access to a vaccine, which means that the situation is getting very, very difficult in developed economies. In the United States, it is quite probable that if there is a new administration, lockdowns will be implemented. We are seeing lockdowns implemented in countries that rejected the idea, like, for example, Austria recently in Europe. So you're absolutely right. The erosion of the potential of growth and the weakness of the economy is something that is much more important and certainly much more challenging than what markets are willing to take into account. And everybody seems to be betting aggressively on the combination of massive monetary stimulus plus the idea that vaccines will solve everything at some point.
Let's talk about how this transmits into the bond market, because we also see the U.S. 10-year, as we're speaking on Monday morning, we're looking at a 90 basis point yield, which is the highest I remember seeing in the last several months. It seems like, you know, you could explain that as the reverse safety trade, where money is coming out of bonds and moving back into stocks as people have a greater risk appetite. But wait a minute, if the expectation is really around a lot of government stimulus, wouldn't that suggest lower yields?
I think that you're absolutely right. There is something that does not add up in the way in which markets are reacting right now. No? On one side, you see that bond yields, sovereign bond yields are going up. Yet at the same time, you see, for example, that often called for weakness in the US dollar is not happening as expected. It's remaining pretty much where it was. You see that the general perception about risk appetite is divided between the most cyclical part of the stock market, the most cyclical part of risky assets. Let's consider the so-called value stocks. We've seen, for example, banks and energy stocks rally. So it's been more, in my opinion, more sort of trying to buy the laggards into an environment in which bond yields are gradually shifting higher on the idea that massive fiscal stimulus will not necessarily be compensated with the amount of monetary stimulus that would bring yields lower. So I think that something doesn't add up, and I think it's likely the decision from some market participants to buy into the more cyclical part of the risky asset availability. I think that what you have right now is probably an unwinding of an overly crowded trade into the elections and into the second wave of the coronavirus, and that will gradually move to something closer to what you've just mentioned, which is that the 10-year yield in the U.S. bond will go lower and that we'll see a lower appetite for banks, for example, in energy stocks and the so-called value cyclical stocks in the forthcoming 2 months, something like that.
Daniel, a subject that we've debated quite a bit with other guests recently on Macro Voices is whether or not we're headed toward a return to secular inflation, not just a little blip of inflation, but secular inflation, 1970s-style stagflation, potentially. And the argument that some people have made is, look, if you have a new administration that's going to favor a lot of deficit spending, the MMT narrative is gaining popularity with politicians. It just seems that we're headed toward a lot of money printing, a lot of deficit spending, and it has to eventually lead toward a lot of inflation. Would you agree with that view, or is there another side to this story?
Well, I think that there is certainly a risk of stagflation, but more in the midterm. We will first probably see a very aggressive level of deflation, because inflation only happens when the newly created money is going to the real economy, and therefore it becomes a massive devaluation of the purchasing power of the currency, which leads to a widespread rise in prices despite no economic growth. In this case, what is happening is that newly created money is going to bonds and fundamentally to sovereign bonds, obviously. And therefore, inflation is being generated and massively in sovereign bonds. We have in the Eurozone countries that are all but bankrupt or completely insolvent, financing themselves at the lowest yields in history. That is massive inflation. Okay. So, when all of that newly created money is utilized by governments to do two things. One is to perpetuate overcapacity and current spending that does not generate real economic return, the reality is that it does not create inflation the way that we would expect, because you're basically adding overcapacity to overcapacity that makes it impossible to generate inflation. Second, the newly created money goes actually to current spending with no real economic return. So it's very difficult to see the levels of inflation that we saw in the 70s. And also, economies are much more open. Everybody's exporting, so that makes it more difficult. However, on the other side, what you have is a situation that I find fascinating, is that while the official CPI, official index of consumer prices, is very low, the goods and services that people actually want to buy are actually rising much faster than real wages, than nominal wages, and than the official CPI. So, for example, we're seeing how healthcare, education, food, clothing, utility bills, those elements are actually going faster. And what's coming down is everything that is subject to technology. So non-replicable goods go up faster than official CPI, and replicable goods go down significantly. Technology, tourism, hospitality, you name it. So I think that what we are seeing right now is that on one side, central banks do not see inflation, and on the other side, you have a growing discontent among the lower classes, the less well-off, and the middle class, because the access to goods and services is more challenging. Cost of living is rising faster than nominal and real wages. So in my opinion, the risk of what is going on right now with the policy of central banks is first ignoring that the cost of living for the people in the middle to lower classes is rising much faster. Second is to ignore the fact that there is actually a level of inflation in financial assets that is significantly more worrying than what anybody would imagine. Think about this. Just an increase of 100 basis points in the yields of Southern European countries would really bring them to absolute collapse in an environment in which 100 basis points would still be at a completely abnormal level of yield. So I think that the problem from the central bank perspective is that they're doing the following. Central banks are looking at the rearview mirror. It's like somebody driving down the road at 250 miles an hour, looking at the rearview mirror and saying, we haven't crashed yet, let's accelerate. And the point here is that the risk of stagflation is rising very, very rapidly because of those factors that I mentioned, because the non-replicable goods and services are rising faster than expected, and because at the same time, the economy is stagnating because of the debt saturation effect.
Daniel, a few minutes ago, you said that we have a situation where countries, which are frankly not all that solvent, are borrowing at historically low yields. And then just a moment ago, you said they really can't tolerate even 100 basis point backup in yields. Now, when we've talked about this problem relative to the United States, most experts we've talked to have said, look, in theory, you know, you get to a situation where they can't pay their bills. But look, the U.S. can just print money and pay its bills. And it's going to be a long time before the world gives up on the U.S. as the world's reserve currency just because they used a little bit of MMT. On the other hand, as I look at peripheral European countries that are borrowing in perhaps reckless ways, is there at some point an intervention by the ECB, which is maybe not so much a bailout, but to stop them from going further? Because if I was the ECB looking at some of these countries, I'd be saying, look, our whole currency system is being put at risk by the least solvent countries in the union still borrowing when, frankly, they've already done more borrowing than they should have done. On the other hand, if you cut them off, you could be crashing their economies. That's not good either. What is the trade-off, or what is the challenge that the ECB is facing with respect to the borrowing habits of the peripheral countries that are not in the greatest shape?
Yeah, I think that the problem here is of understanding when this activity, when this whole craziness stops working, okay? And it stops working in a moment that it's very difficult to predict from the perspective of a central banker, which is when the global demand for a currency stops rising, starts to go down, no? When you see for example, in countries like Argentina, like Turkey, like Iran, the level of inflation that they have and the level of weakness in access to investors and being able to borrow. The reality is that what has driven to all of that is that the global demand for their currency has not only fallen, but also domestic demand for the currency. In the case of the United States can print as only as much as the demand that is that exists globally for US dollars is out there. So you can only print as much as the global demand dictates. It's not what the Fed decides. It's not what the government decides. Deficits are financed only because there is a perception globally that holding US treasuries is a good investment, and that the purchasing power of the US dollar is going to remain relatively stable compared to my local currency. So if I'm a citizen in Brazil, I prefer to invest in dollar assets and US treasuries because I know that the US dollar plus the yield that I get out of that bond, first, I'm going to receive my money back. Second, the purchasing power of that dollar is going to be higher than the purchasing power of the real. That moved globally, okay? So the limits of MMT are the limits that the world demand of a currency dictates. And that is not decided by the government. The government just cannot go out and print as much as it wants. It can only print as much as it is demanded. And that demand is weakening the moment that the level of growth and therefore the security that the United States will repay its debt is hindered. So the point that I get to, and that comes back to the European Union, is that you accept that southern economies in the European Union take more debt because you believe that when they recover, they grow faster and they generate a higher level of activity for the European Union. So It's a leverage buyout, if I may put that example. It's basically just using leverage to give some money to countries that when they grow more. Now, the problem is that once you've started to let those countries reach 120, 130, 180% debt to GDP, is that when they fall as abruptly as we are seeing right now, 7, 10%, 12% in the case of Spain, and they don't recover as fast. Therefore, that's when you really start to scare the global investor about the prospect of getting your money back in terms of the debt that you have acquired and the purchasing power of that asset. And that is very important. And that's something that needs to be repeated over and over again to all of those that say that the United States can print all the money that it wants without a problem. That is not true. It can only print the money that the rest of the world accepts as a collateral to their own investments, to their savings. In fact, the US dollar as a world reserve currency and the US deficit financed by the rest of the world, even if a vast majority of it is also financed by the Federal Reserve, at the end of the day, the connecting point to all of that is whether a citizen out there globally believes that a US dollar is going to have a stronger purchasing power in the future than the domestic currency, be it the euro, be it the real, the peso, you name it, doesn't matter. So this is something that at least historically, I have had the opportunity and the honor of working with a few people from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve always paid attention to global demand of dollars. Now, what is the problem with the European Central Bank? The European Central Bank did the opposite. It said, look, if we finance the excessive deficits of the peripheral countries, then the growth in internal demand of those peripheral countries, once they recover, is going to absorb all of the excess of euros that we have placed in the market. That is a very dangerous trade, because if Spain, Italy fall in 2020, 12%, 10% their GDP, and you see in 2021 that they recover 4%, 5%, then that quid pro quo, that trade, that leverage trade against the higher growth of the future breaks, which is what generated the destruction of the carry trade in emerging market currencies. We saw last year, and we have seen in 2020, and we saw it last year as well, how despite a dollar that was not rising at all, actually, in the dollar DXY index, you had most of the emerging market currencies collapsing. So the United States, be it with Joe Biden, be it with anybody else, needs to understand that the moment that it starts to implement policies that will put a burden on growth, that put a burden on jobs, that create more slack in the economy, and therefore the productivity growth is weaker, then it puts at risk the US dollar as the world reserve currency, and with it, the ability of the United States government to finance its deficit. So it's a very, very thin line, and it's definitely no way, in no way, what MMT defenders think. There is absolutely no possibility for the United States to continue to be a country that delivers on the promise of growth and repayment of its debt with excessive money printing that is constantly used for malinvestment and non-productive, non-economic return spending. It's because it's the formula of the European Union. The moment that you start to see that the United States starts to get into the stagnation mode of the European Union, then the risk of the US dollar being the world reserve currency, and with it, the ability of the government and the Fed to finance the deficit with a level of, let's say, easiness that that they expect, that is broken very, very quickly.
I understand the currency demand argument, particularly as it relates to the United States dollar. It seems to me in Europe, though, that the levers are a little bit different in the sense that while there could be demand, let's say lots of demand for euros, there might be no demand for Greek or Spanish government bonds, which are denominated in euros. The problem, though, is that as the yield starts to back up and it threatens those economies, now the ECB is presented with the conundrum of, okay, do they print in order to buy those bonds in order to rescue the peripheral countries? It seems to me at some point you get to, just as the United States has had a lot of divisiveness over politics, it seems to me at some point you get a core versus periphery tension in Europe where the core is saying the ECB should not be in the business of bailing out peripheral nations that are borrowing too much. How does that get resolved? And what could it mean in terms of potentially a peripheral Europe sovereign bond crisis? And how would the ECB be expected to react to that in this new MMT world where it seems like money printing is a lot more palatable to more people than it used to be?
It's a very, very good question. Monetary policy in the Eurozone should be what it was designed to be, which is a tool to provide countries time to implement the structural reforms that are going to allow them to be stronger, more productive, and more solvent in the future. However, monetary policy in the Eurozone has gone from being a tool that looks to provide some time for governments to implement structural reforms to being an excuse not to implement them. And that tension between the North and the South is already happening. You've seen it, for example, with the European Recovery Fund, how immediately there was this idea that the frugal countries were attacking the southern European countries because they did not want to monetize and mutualize all of the spending without question. No? Because solidarity mechanisms exist in the Eurozone, but they don't have to be something that goes from being a solidarity mechanism to a donation mechanism, and especially a donation to perpetuate and accelerate the structural imbalances and the weaknesses of the economy. So what I think that the European Central Bank should do is to be a lot less strict about the rules. I think that the only thing that they need to do is to follow very, very simple rules by which both sides feel that there is a support, but at the same time, it's not a perverse incentive to undo reforms, which is what we're seeing, for example, in Spain, or at some point we saw in Italy. And everything, just like in the United States, it would be solved as well, would be solved with a set of measures in which discretionality of the individuals at the European Central Bank is limited. So, for example, you have an asset purchase program. The asset purchase program goes to X amount of bonds, but it doesn't go beyond that. And you say it very clearly, you explain it well in advance, communication consistent and constant about those rules so that it's very clear that those are the rules and those have to be implemented. And then you have at least some level of security that governments will not use the period of expansionary monetary policies to simply get worse and to become almost too big to fail, no? As you were mentioning. So, because what's happening right now is the following, and we saw it in between 2014 and 2017 with Mario Draghi. Mario Draghi used to go to the market and say, monetary policy is not enough. countries have to implement structural reforms. If structural reforms are not implemented, monetary policy is not going to work. And literally, governments heard that the same way as they could hear a commercial on TV. They just didn't even pay any attention. So what ends up happening is that governments would be at least aware that they could not use monetary policy to continue to increase the imbalances of the economy. And the European Central Bank, the only thing that needs to do is to follow very strictly those rules. That would certainly prevent the perverse incentive that is being created right now.
Daniel, technically, there's still an open question in the U.S. election, but it seems pretty darn clear that Joe Biden is going to defeat Donald Trump as the next president of the United States. And that probably means what I consider to be kind of a reversal of U.S. policy, where it used to be China, bad guy, Russia, okay, or at least a little bit okay. I think that's maybe about to switch to where, unlike Trump's policy, I think Biden is much more likely to be friendlier with China, but much less friendly with Russia from a purely geopolitical standpoint. What would that mean? First of all, do you agree with that interpretation? But if so, what would it mean for markets?
I kind of agree. I think that if there's anything that seems pretty clear about the policies that Joe Biden wants to implement, it is that he will have a policy with China very, very similar to the one that was implemented throughout the Obama tenure, the 8 years of the Obama administration in which he was vice president. So what would that mean for markets? What we know about that period is the following. It basically allows the Chinese government to devalue the currency and to increase the trade surplus with the United States without any consequence. So if you start to lift tariffs and you start to allow an economy, China, that has been closing down actually in the last years and become less transparent, not more transparent, there is certainly going to be a process like we saw in the 8 years of the Obama administration, in which the Chinese government basically aims to maximize the trade surplus and maximize at the same time its competitive advantage by devaluing the yuan. I think that also, from the perspective of markets, I don't think that the relationship with Russia is very important, to be fairly honest. I think that before, the relationship with Russia was important for one reason. Throughout the Obama administration, the United States went from being the biggest importer of oil to one of the biggest producers of oil. It's interesting because everybody sees it as a sort of very green administration, but it is true that the fracking revolution happened throughout those years. So I think that what we will likely see is a much weaker position from the United States in terms of defending its market. Because ultimately, if you look at the world geopolitically, you have one market where all of the exporters want to sell, the United States, and one market where all of the exporters want to produce, which is China. Cost and consumer. No, consumer and cost. So I think that if Joe Biden implements that policy, now is not the same as it was in 2009. In 2009, the Chinese had a strict and open view about liberalizing and strengthening and being more transparent and being more open. It was very few years ago, actually at the end of the Obama administration, in which the Chinese government went from opening the economy to shutting down the economy. So obviously it would be bad for U.S. exporters, it would be bad also for the inflationary expectations of the Biden administration, because China exports deflation. It would be bad, certainly, for manufacturing jobs. And it would be certainly, at least from the perspective of markets, it would reduce the cost of capital risk attached to the investments in China and in countries close to China. So obviously, all of that can be debatable, but I think that it would be like coming back to 2009, but with a Chinese economy that is not the same as in 2009.
Daniel, let's go back to fracking and Joe Biden. On one hand, he's kind of tough about fracking. On the other hand, if he goes to Pennsylvania, the story seems to change a little bit. What do you think his true intentions are? Does the U.S. shale industry face a major threat from Joe Biden?
It's interesting that markets have reacted with a massive buying of energy stocks and the fracking stocks after the at least announcement from the media that Joe Biden could be the winner. And the reason why I think that is happening is because if Joe Biden really understands anything about energy, he knows that you cannot have low unemployment in the states that are fully devoted to, that are mainly devoted to energy and to manufacturing. You cannot have low unemployment and at the same time a green economy today. And that there's only one way in which the United States gets into a competitive energy transition to a more green model, which is with the combination of renewables and natural gas. And when we talk natural gas is fracking. So banning fracking would be disastrous for both the employment situation of the United States and the investment situation of the United States, and it would be very, very negative for the energy transition that they want to implement. A competitive energy transition system can only happen with the combination of natural gas and renewables, as they did, by the way, in the years in which Obama was in the administration, where you saw that the United States was the only country in the world in which the development of renewables didn't make utility bills, electricity and gas, soar, thanks to the competition with natural gas and oil from the fracking revolution. Therefore, if Joe Biden decides to shoot the U.S. economy in the foot and ban fracking, you would have the outcome that Germany saw. Germany decided to shut down the nuclear plants and to invest everything in renewables with massive subsidies. Utility bills soared for household consumers. And today, as we speak, they depend more on lignite, which is coal, and on Russian gas than no one ever expected. So the point that I'm trying to make is that if he truly cares about growth, jobs, and the economy, he must understand that you cannot offset the jobs lost in manufacturing and in energy with jobs in the renewable business. I have been investing all my life in renewables. You don't need the number of employees that you need in a solar plant or in a group of windmills compared to the ones that you need in a group of oil rigs. So the point that I'm trying to make is, one, he needs to develop a plan of competitive energy transition. If he puts the as leaders of that plan, the most ideologically driven people in the Democratic Party, that would be atrocious for utility bills, for households, for jobs, and for growth. So I think that, you know, if they've learned anything about the last years, is that the United States has been one of the very few countries that has been able to reduce emissions without increasing utility bills for households, that employment has gone to record levels, and at the same time, it is a leader in renewable investments. All of that comes from one beautiful word, competition, that does not exist in so many other developed economies in the Eurozone in terms of energy. And that's what they need to do. Competition and technology will drive the energy transition better for everybody than intervention from the side of the most ideologically driven people in the Democratic Party.
Daniel, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. For the benefit of our accredited investor and institutional audience, please tell them where they can learn more information about the fund that you manage. And for the non-accredited audience, is there a blog or a Twitter handle, or how can they follow your work?
Thank you very much. Yes, you can follow the funds that I'm working at, all at Tresis, T-R-E-S-S-I-S. And you can also follow me on Twitter at DLACALLE_IA or my website, DLACALLE.com. So not difficult to find. You put Daniel Lacalle on Google, you'll find me pretty easily, and hope to continue the dialogue with everyone.
Thanks so much. We look forward to getting you back for another interview in a few months. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, is a contrarian investment whose returns are historically uncorrelated to other asset classes. Low uranium prices lasted for many years after the Fukushima meltdown, leading to substantial supply destruction. At today's prices, uranium mining is uneconomical even for the world's lowest cost producers. Uranium demand is already estimated to exceed existing supply, and future demand growth is expected. New mines aren't economically viable at today's prices, leading analysts to predict that the price of uranium may need to double to over $60 per pound to incentivize sufficient new mine supply to meet expected demand. The NYSE-listed North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, offers investors exposure to both miners and holders of uranium. For more information, visit urnmetf.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Daniel come on and just give us an update of what's going on in Europe. But I also wanted to just circle back here and just get an update from you as to how things are progressing and evolving in with COVID around the world.
Patrick, to be clear, the vaccine news is good news, and I don't mean to diminish that, but we've got to keep it in perspective. So many people in the press are acting like, oh, okay, so what's going to happen is they're going to get emergency use authorization next week, and then the week after that, the crisis is over. Look, in the case of the Pfizer vaccine, it requires extreme refrigeration, which nobody's really got a plan to do on a large-scale basis. I think that that vaccine has lots and lots of promise, but they're probably only going to be able to use it for healthcare workers and in a very limited distribution capacity until they're able to improve it to change its refrigeration requirements for distribution. The way it's designed right now, it has to be stored at super-duper cold temperatures until about 2 hours before it's used, or something like that. The Moderna vaccine, which also has similar 95% or so effectiveness results from its early clinical trials, has about equal promise in terms of its efficacy, but it doesn't have as difficult of a distribution challenge. So I think the Moderna vaccine is actually the more promising in the sense that Pfizer's got some work to do to overcome this refrigeration challenge. Moderna appears to be ready to start mass producing this stuff fairly soon. But no matter how you slice it, Patrick, the fact that something is 95% effective is not the only number that you look at. If it's 99.999% effective and it also has a side effect that kills for 5% of the people, you can't use it at all. We haven't gotten through the clinical approval process. They are going to fast track it with an emergency use authorization. Probably what happens next is they'll roll it out to healthcare workers first, in order to make the people on the front lines immunized, it's going to take some number of months or quarters. It's probably into the second half of 2021. You heard Daniel Lecaille's estimate that even at the end of 2021, there would be at most about 40% of people would have been immunized. I don't know where he gets that particular number from. I'm sure that's somebody's estimate. I'm sure there's more optimistic estimates. But it's not like in January, the whole planet is going to be immunized and we can forget about this crisis. The other thing that we don't know yet is the immunity to this type of virus generally doesn't last as long. So we know already that these vaccines, you can't just get one shot. You got to get two separate shots in order to be immunized. How long does that last? Is it only good for a year? Is it good for less than a year? I don't even know the answer to that yet. We'll find out. The point is, there's something coming that hopefully is going to make a meaningful difference, but it's probably in the second half toward the end, let's say the fourth quarter of 2021, before the vaccine has been administered to enough people around the world that it meaningfully changes the impact of the virus on world travel and so on and so forth. So there's lots of reason for optimism. Meanwhile, the stark reality that we're facing right now today is a dramatic increase in new cases, new hospitalizations, and new deaths. And that increase in hospitalizations is starting to put the healthcare system at risk. And it's when you get to the point where the healthcare system is at risk of being overwhelmed that governments are forced to consider lockdown measures. So I think it's very possible that we'll be looking at a new round of lockdowns in the United States and elsewhere around the world this winter. And I think we're going to see more economic downside as a result of the COVID-19 crisis in the next 6 months before we see good news coming in the following 6 months. But what I do know with certainty, Patrick, is that we've got another postgame chart book this week. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads right above Daniel Lecaille's picture. Patrick, first chart here, S&P 500. What's going on?
So, Eric, what I wanted to talk about here is just something you already referenced earlier, which was the fact that we're at such critical moments on so many of these different markets. And rather than trying to play the game of forecasting, it's important to highlight where these levels are and what we have to watch for next week in terms of some of these major breaks. And so the name of the whole chart book is called Holding the Line. And what I wanted to start talking about first was just what's happening with the S&P 500. Now, first of all, what we had was a period that in the post-election window, and then especially after all the vaccine news started coming out, all of this pent-up money that was on the sidelines and all the hedging that was going on and all the extra volatility that was being priced in the market, everything just kind of normalized, and that allowed the S&P 500 to have this just surge higher up towards the 3,600 level. And what we now find ourselves is that we're going into the November option expiration, and we are right pinned to the 3,600 zone, which is where there's like the golf ball and the garden hose in the structure of the options. And so it's very likely it's going to be sticky going into Friday's close. And so just using some of Charlie McElligott's numbers, like the S&P's to the 97th percentile on delta dollars with 30% of the gamma set to roll off this weekend. The QQQ has 50% of its gamma rolling off. IWM, which is the small caps, 39%, and even the emerging markets, 36%. So there's this unpinning going to happen after the weekend. And so it's amazing that we're seeing all of these markets all wound up at these critical moments. And then we're going into this option expiration where we're about to roll off. I asked the question, are we about to see some volatility return back to the market starting on Monday? And that's what we're watching for sure. And so on S&P chart on page 3, I just have the 36 6,600 line drawn out there. The interesting part will be is that will we just get a very natural retracement of this post-election surge we had? What's interesting is that even a natural Fibonacci retracement would be towards 3,400, which most traders will find it very hard to stomach a 150 to 200 S&P point pullback that would not even be the beginning of a correction. That would just be the market backfilling some of the election pop. And it'll be really interesting to see whether that comes in early next week on that. And so what the other thing I wanted to highlight was on page 4, which is the volatility. And one of the things that we saw contributing to the market upside was the huge contraction of volatility. There was this big volatility premium, a lot of money on the sideline, and then we saw that backing right off. And we're back down to pretty much the 2020 lows in the post-coronavirus period. And one of the interesting things is that we have this major support line of volatility, yet the average volatility prior to the coronavirus was all the way down, always in the low teens. And one of the interesting things that I think we can watch is whether or not volatility here finds the lows along this new higher level, or whether or not we're going to still continue to see lower volatility levels.
Patrick, let's move on to the dollar index on page 5. Seems like we're holding really right around that 92 handle as the bottom of the trading range. What do you see next here?
This is the same theme, which is we're at a critical support, and the price action has been incredibly weak, incredibly distributive, but it is a very crowded trade to be bearish the dollar. And so there's obviously room, if the support holds, for it to go squeezing higher. But at this stage, there's almost no price action supporting a US dollar rally. It's so very weak. And what would be interesting is that if this level gave out, the next major support is all the way down at the 89.90 level, going back to 2018, that would certainly be a tailwind for the euro. And so watching into next week, whether or not the dollar can hold the support line is going to be high on the watch list in terms of things to keep an eye on.
It's fascinating that the dollar and gold are both at the bottom of their ranges. Normally, the dollar and gold, at least most of the time, trade inversely to one another, but they're both testing the bottom of their ranges. Since we can see, starting on page 6, that the other currencies are at the top of their ranges, you know, the dollar index is the one that's making sense. The gold is the odd man out there. What do you make of that?
We could talk about gold when we get to that chart, but we can see where the US dollar weakness is coming from. The euro, obviously being the largest trade-weighted component of the dollar index, is the predominant driver of that dollar index. And so that euro continues to gravitate to the top end of that range, and it'll be really interesting. It'll be very hard for the dollar index to break down without the euro correspondingly leading the way, surging higher. And so this is going to be, I think, the most important of the currency pairs to watch to see what's happening. But what's really interesting is that whether it's the euro, whether it's the Aussie dollar on page 7, or even the Canadian dollar that's not on here, those two commodity-based currencies or influenced currencies by commodities are gravitating again to the top end of the ranges. It's like everything in this macro space is coming to an important crossroad. And it feels like next week will be potentially a really big week for determining whether or not these are going to be big breakouts. And that's for sure what we're going to watch.
Yeah, and we see it here on page 8 with crude oil. And the way I assess this is, even though you would think that the long-dated crude oil futures would be up and the short-dated ones would be down, the market never works that way. If the market is looking ahead toward there being relief to the crisis next year, what people are buying is the front month contract. And I think that's what's holding us at the top of this range. It'll be very interesting to see if we break out of it. I think we ought to go test the bottom of the range first as we get through the next few months of difficulty. And I definitely think much, much higher crude oil prices are in store for us by the end of 2021. By 1 year from now, I will be shocked if we don't have considerably higher crude prices than we have now. But in the meantime, I think there's plenty of room for a significant move lower first.
You know, one of the things that I'm going to be watching is whether or not everything stays in line from a natural intermarket correlation. Certainly, if the dollar was to start breaking down with some sort of velocity, that would act as a tailwind to a crude oil breakout. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether or not crude oil kind of follows that script or whether it can kind of march to the beat of its own drum. One way or another, what's interesting is those energy stocks that we talked about last week continued to be accumulated very well. So at least there's some conviction out there that there's been a turning point of some sort, at least enough to accumulate those energy stocks. So it'll be interesting to see whether oil goes along with that story. And so now on page 9, I want to move on to gold.
Now can we talk about gold now that we're on that chart?
Yes, there we go. We can talk about gold now. But you were bang on. It's really interesting to the fact that gold has been so weak, but it's been almost perfectly correlated to the weakness of the dollar. And obviously, we've had no shortage of macro voice guests that come on and talked about, obviously, gold's correlation with real yields, which has been what's been pressuring gold to one degree or another here. But it's certainly also interesting, and we don't have a chart to speak to it, but really, gold was, for the longest time, also viewed as a safe haven asset to the same in the same category as Bitcoin. But Bitcoin has been just screaming higher in a full-on bull market parabolic rise, and gold has just been left behind. And it's really something that a lot of people in the FinTwit world have been highlighting. And it certainly will be interesting to see whether that this trend continues or whether gold is just late to the party and that the reversal will inevitably come. So finally, I want to touch on the chart on page 10, which is the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And it's interesting that it has many of the same characteristics that those cross currencies have and crude oil has. It's like bouncing its head up along the top end of resistance. A lot of the different commodities are doing very well, particularly the grains and even coffee's had a really good run recently. And so you're seeing a lot of commodities doing very well, including copper having broken to a higher high. And yet this commodity index is sort of just crawling along that upper boundary. And my call on all of this is that either it's all going to break out or none of it's going to break out. I think that it's the single most important thing to keep an eye out for next week is that are we going to see everything just get charged with all sorts of new momentum and some of these big breakouts really start to follow through? And that's for sure what's on my watch list.
Well, Patrick, I agree with that sentiment that this could go either way, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens because in a lot of these cases, I see it as time frames. On one hand, like let's take copper. On one hand, copper is traditionally a kind of a barometer for the economic condition. If we're going to have an economic downturn because of this massive increase in cases and hospitalizations and deaths in the COVID-19 crisis, copper's probably going to take a hit here. But you know that if the Biden presidency is going to happen, which it appears that it's almost certain to, you know a major theme of a Biden presidency is going to be green energy. There's probably going to be a combination of emphasis on electric vehicles, which you need copper to build, and also a build out of a new electric grid, a new distribution grid for the United States, because there's no possible way that the current one can recharge a meaningful increase in the number of electric vehicles that we already have. So there's a huge, huge, huge copper demand. And you've got prices of copper generally moving up in an inflationary environment, which is going to be created by all of the money printing that's coming. So you know copper's got to be headed much higher, very much the same story as oil. It's just, does it have a leg down first? That's the part I can't decide about. What I do know is that our listeners can get a 14-day free trial of Big Picture Trading. Find the details on page 11. We're going to leave it there for this week's show, folks. Don't forget, next week we'll be with you on Wednesday evening instead of Thursday because of the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. This episode was made possible by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium, and by the Perth Mint's Gold Pass, the market-leading investment and trading app from the Perth Mint. Buy, sell, transfer, and redeem government-guaranteed gold securely on your smartphone. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart book that we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to a variant perception blog titled "The ECB May End Up Absorbing All of the Government Supply in 2021, and a link to an article titled "The Buffett Indicator, Why Investors Are Walking into a Trap." So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.